it is possible for the gods, and it may be possible for us to at least try, and a good thing that we try to acquire that wisdom.
But if this is this that quest occurs, if some in the Yudhisthira, there it occurs, because Yudhisthira claims to be an expert in these matters. And Kruva is neither Kranjas nor Ktisivas, nor the two brothers ever refer to this possibility. And Siddhas himself doesn't do it. So I think it is no reason to be exact.
The suggestion you made that perhaps the reference to the an affirmation that there is such a thing as wisdom. In other words, that it isn't a meaningless thing.
To that extent, sure.
That's all.
That is pretty true. That is true, because it was not a meaningless thing that goes without saying. Otherwise, his whole life would not be indulging without that. Yes. Well, let us go to the next second part. The second part of Siddhartha's long, protracted speech.
We came to an agreement in the end, I don't know how, to sum up thus. When wisdom is present, whoever has it needs no more good fortune. And when we had come to this agreement, I asked him how our former agreements would stand now. We agreed, I said, that if we had plenty of good things, we should be happy and do well.
See, now I'm here that uses the term be happy or damonain, which I haven't used before. Yes.
His conclusion is quite a bit different than use of wisdom before. Wisdom being related to success in sea faring or success in battle. But here he says, when wisdom is present, whoever has it needs no more. He doesn't really need success in battle or really in seamanship. If he has wisdom, well, he may have these things, but they're
He doesn't need good fortune as something independent, because it is implied in wisdom.
Yes. I think there's been a change in emphasis. It was, wisdom is kind of vindicated by good fortune before, now good fortune by wisdom.
Wisdom was not vindicated before. Wisdom was needed to be a good thing first. And so, once in a while, they said, we need good fortune in addition. And once in a while, they said, come to think of it now. Because whoever is wise has good fortune as a consequence of his wisdom. And therefore, whoever is good, or what is new, you can say, is the fairness with which Siddhartha is after these complicated examples which he had given makes this conclusion. The sheer presence of wisdom makes superfluous good fortune. Makes superfluous good fortune, yes. But that means what I call the omnipotence of wisdom. If you have wisdom, you have everything. But this, however, this leads to a great difficulty, as you will see from the sequel.
He assented. Then should we be happy because of the good things we had if they gave us benefit or if they did not?
What is the difficulty? We have perhaps not. The difficulty is we have a long list of good things. And if virtue is omnipotent, are we not any good things apart from wisdom? Now this must be clear up, and then we will learn the secret. Now we will see at the beginning. Now as I just said at the beginning, when Mr. Brandon had 1280B5, we have to meet if more good things were present with us, we would be happier and do well.
He assented. Then shouldn't it be happy because of the good things we had, if they gave us benefit or if they did not? If they gave us benefit, he said. And would a thing give benefit if we only had it but did not use it? Such as if we had plenty of food but ate nothing, and plenty of drink but drank nothing, should we get any benefit? No, indeed, he said. And all the craftsmen now, if each of them had everything ready that was necessary for his work, but used nothing, would these do well just because of having, because they had all the things which the craftsman must have? A carpenter, for instance, if he had provided all his tools and wood enough, but did no carpentering, would he get any benefit from just having? None at all, he said. Again, if a man who possessed a well...
Now, let me stop you for one moment. So, it's not the perception that a man is still well, does not mean he is happy. Yes, that's perhaps that's problem.
Again, if a man were possessed of wealth and all of the good things we named lately, but if he did not use them, would he be happy because he possessed the good things? No, indeed, Socrates.
So give me another distinction between perception and use. And the key, we will call it happy or to the use of things, not to the perception of them. Now, let us join us on that, or keep things in this similarity. It's God's use. Can we use the things if you do not possess them? For example, take this carpenter who was there before. He would not be benefited if it was just a wood, a timber, lime, and the tools. But he must work on them, he must use them. But if he does not have the timber and the tools, if he does not possess them, what is the use of using them? Do you see the point?
Some things like universities, for example, you use them, but you do not possess them.
It's still, because you have them, nevertheless, it comes back in a somewhat disguised form, that you are a student registered here, either having a scholarship, or paying your fee, whatever the case may be, and then here the question of possessions would come in. But in general, words, that this is a question of cooperation. It's coming up here in another form. Meaning that you need the things which you do not get through your wisdom, but are conditioned for the use of your wisdom. I remember it's actually not the first chapter of the Infants of Communicus, but this question is discussed in rather length, and both the questions and much more clearly is it probably a question than it is here. But it is the same question. Yes. But let us know if we find our level closely. So in other words, it is the section about you read. I must have the one who wishes to be happy must...
But the one who is to be happy must not only get possession of such good things, but also must use them, or else there is no benefit from having them.
That's it, then. But that would be to say it more precisely than possession. And the question is exactly what happens to the possessionless fellow. That is an interesting question. And this is the position of the condition that is outside some description of the equipment which you need, you know? Water plus equipment. Without that, happiness is not possible. And the equipment is not in itself an outcome of virtue. Yes? These are good of virtue. You need good fortune to have the goods of fortune. Yes?
You speak true. Very well then, Clinias. Is that enough now to make a man happy, both to possess the good things and to use them? I think so. Is that if he uses them correctly, or is it the same if he uses them wrongly?
You see, here comes is simply refused the answer that they said he was too rash. In it was actually something that the Jews and such would have done. It was a good answer, of course. Yes. As a correct Jews. Yes?
Correctly. You speak in a fine way, said I.
This is it now. After years, almost twice, didn't they say that?
It is more harmful, I should think, if one loses anything wrongly than if one leaves it alone. The first is bad. The second is neither bad nor good. Don't you agree? He agreed. Very well. In the working and the use of woodwork, that which produces the right use is nothing other than knowledge of carpentry, is it? No, indeed, he said. And somehow in the production of furniture, correct knowledge is what does the work. He assented. Well then, I said, what about the use of the good things which we mentioned at first? Wealth and health and good looks.
What is the good memory of Socrates? Mm-hmm. These are the things that he says.
For using all of such things right, was knowledge the guide which directed the action, or was it something else? Knowledge, he said. Then not only good fortune, but good doing, as it seems, is provided by knowledge for human beings in every getting and doing. He agreed. Then in the name of Zeus, I said, does any benefit come from the other possessions without prudence and wisdom? Could a man get benefit?
Yes, Brahma's trying that. He will do it. He will achieve what is a high good. And this is very important. Now he shows that wisdom is the same good. And he's preparing it by what part of that paragraph was said that it is so because no good is truly good for us unless it is rightly used. But right using is what a person consists. Hence, wisdom is its own good. Yes?
Why do you say wisdom is the sole good? Wisdom consists in the proper use of goods other than wisdom, those goods acquired by fortune.
Yeah, but you must distinguish between what Socrates argues out here and the truth. Wisdom, what he tries to argue as an example, is understanding that wisdom is a soul good. And the difficulty which you refer to them, which we mentioned earlier, is the difference between the concept used but opposes possession. And the only way I had to know this, that use is the only title to the right words. It's the only title to possession, which is a better representation of reduction. And at all times, in all societies, including China and Soviet Russia. But the only thing is because the consequences is the only man who can be called rightful possessor, not what he happens to have for going to work, but of all things, is a nice man. The conclusion drawn according to the textbooks by the Stoics, but implicit in Plato and Aristotle, and in Zenobia all the time. Yes. In B6, I think, yeah.
Could a man get benefit possessing plenty and doing much if he had no intelligence? Would he not benefit more by doing little with intelligence?
It's considered. Yeah, you're speaking about what the youth is knowledge, thoughts, prayers, wisdom, and intelligence synonymously here. Well, this means it doesn't work. These fine distinctions important very in all respects, and he deliberately disregarded. However, he required, and he prepared for a secret expression of intelligence, loose. Yes?
Just consider, if he did less, he would make fewer mistakes. If he made fewer mistakes, he would do less badly. If he did less badly, he would be less miserable.
It is clear. It is clear. If he is unindulgent, the less he does, the less he does, the better for everyone. And I think it's some of the experienced people saying, listen, that man, everyone should die. Yes, no, said yes.
What do you think of the last lines in the apology where he talks about his children? How if they do good, they will get all the other good things. Well, the most important thing is that you do good even though you don't have it. You can still act good even if you don't get all the other things. And if you act well, then these other things will come. I know.
His argument, though, goes beyond that. He seems to go so far as to say that the man who isn't intelligent shouldn't possess and use food because he isn't sure of knowing how, according to this argument.
Yes.
Which would be more likely to do less, a poor man or a rich man? A poor man, he said. A weak man or a strong man? A weak man. An honored man or a man without honor?
Not conspicuous, not VIP.
Would a brave and temperate man do less, or a coward? A coward.
Is this strange? Is this not? Is the guy who tried to get his EC, he would not do less mischief than the greatest man. Is it part of his anonymous word courage? But what about the modern man? He sees a clever and impulsive question. He sees the identical parents, the courageous and modern man on the one hand, and the courage on the other. He doesn't speak of the indirect man. So he makes the issue more invisible to poor Claudius.
He also leaves out justice.
And order God, yes. The text there, What Kant derives is the thought that there is nothing in the world that is to be respected except the good will. And then he eliminates all things which we esteem. And all the two things, courage and moderation, courage and tenderness. And Kant says they can also be bad. Tenderness can be the worst for doing the most bad things. Is a demonstration, of course, of courage. In the ordinary sense of the word courage. But Kant does not mention justice. And this implies, since the good word is a move from moderation, from justice. I do not believe that Kant intended that, but this is in fact so. Now he thought justice is not, the problem of this is, let us just finish that.
He is also an idle rather than an active man, he agreed, and a slow man rather than a quick one, sharp-sighted and hard of hearing rather than sharp. In all such comparisons, we agree. Then to sum up, Clinias, I said, in all those things which we said at first were good, the question is not how they are in themselves by nature good, but this is the point, it seems. If ignorance leads them, they are greater evils than their opposites, inasmuch as they are more able to serve the leader which is evil. But if prudence and wisdom leads, they are greater goods, while in themselves neither kind is worth anything at all. It appears, he said, as it seems, thus, as you say.
Yes?
Then what follows for us from what has been said? That none of the things is either good or bad, except these two, and of these, wisdom is good, and ignorance bad. Do you agree?
So, in other words, there is only a single good, wisdom. And again, you must admit that if you want to persuade someone to pursue wisdom, it's the strongest point you could make in order to urge him on. Chopin by Sophia. This is the center part of the projective speech. We have to settle the last part. But perhaps there are some points you would like to raise. This is for sure.
Socrates is talking to Phineas about the various goods. And Socrates said, suddenly I remembered one and said, by Zeus, we are near you, not the greatest good of all. And he said, what's that? Good fortune. And then a little while long, he says, then I reconsidered and said, he's been lying before us all the time. He's waited before us again and to say the same thing twice is ridiculous. This is reminiscent of the discussion in the Republic on the nature of justice. At the very end of that discussion, that search for justice, Socrates says to his interlocutor, it's the same thing. It's been there all along.
At our feet, on the earth.
With regard to what you said about the omission of justice, doesn't it seem then that there's another good thing, the law? If obeying the law is obeying something that is
You have read last semester the Nicomachean Ethics. So legal things are in a manner. Suggest things. And say things are amended. Or as well as generally speaking, the legal things are the just things. Quite a few exceptions. So in some places more, in other places less. But still, the law is a kind, law is law, is a kind of restraint. But one would also have to consider the alternative, which is much less palatable. What it would mean that the unjust man would do less harm than the just one. which is, I somehow alluded to it. Is that correct?
On the point of man of honor, man of high place, and man in the low place, or in the obscure place, inconspicuous and unseen place, is he there implying that the man in a high place is more likely to do good things because people watch him?
That he has more opportunity to do mischief. Yes. And he can also corrupt many more people by his example.
It's exactly the opposite of people like you, John Adams, Jefferson,
and Churchill. Well, that is, they speak, of course, of intelligent men, and did not speak of unintelligent. Good. Good. Let's come to the third part. If there are further questions.
Then let us consider what remains, I said. Since we all desire to be happy, and we have been shown to be happy by using things and using them aright, and rightness and good fortune were provided by knowledge, what seems to be necessary, as it seems, is that every man in every way shall try to become as wise as possible. Is not that correct? Yes, he said. And I suppose we think that he should get this from his father much rather than wealth, and from guardians and friends, and especially from those who profess to be lovers, strangers and citizens. He should beg and beseech them to give him some wisdom. For wisdom's sake, Clinias, there is no disgrace, no reproach in being servant and slave to a lover and to any human being. For a man willing to give noble service in the passion to become wise. Don't you think so, I said?
Yeah, it's noble service. In other words, this young boy, who is now going to urge everyone to give him wisdom and be willing to do anything that would run from him. So he swings him all noble services. Sometimes you may shine his shoes, but you will not do his America. Yes. Good. This reminds of a passage in the Banquet. This passage, yes. Clinias is now quite articulate.
Certainly, I think you speak well, he replied. Yes, Clinias, I said, if only wisdom can be taught, if only it is not something that comes to human beings of itself. For that is a point we have not considered. That has not yet been agreed between me and you.
Yes, this agreement between Socrates and Paris would, it seems, settle the issue.
Well, Socrates, he said, I think wisdom can be taught.
Yeah, is this the first time that he said Socrates?
No, there was once before.
That's before?
Yeah.
I think we'll be for the future. Oh, it's around, indeed. Oh, indeed, it's in D4, yes. Yeah. That is indeed true. So, it is so good, see? Yeah. It is easy to understand here, when it says Socrates. In this case, well, I know. Yeah, if you read any dance, I know it. And, yes, and what does Socrates say?
I was delighted and replied, you speak well, best of men.
Yeah, that is the strongest expression you will see that is used. No one sees many men, not human beings only. So this is a much stronger expression than the English best of men could be. Because best of men could in English mean also best of human beings. Because of the ambiguity of the word man in English. Yes?
I am much obliged to you for sparing me from a long inquiry. Just that question, whether wisdom can or cannot be taught.
Because Kirkland's assumption, yes.
Now then, since you think it can, and that wisdom alone of things in existence makes a human being happy and fortunate, don't you say it is necessary to philosophize, and don't you mean to do it yourself? That I do, Socrates, he said, as much as I can.
Yes. This is, a book and law that I do not have watched his shoes of Thucydides. But if these are all the only three cases, then the most important case would be as a center, and then I would be the priest. So now, this is the question which Thucydides keeps for the end of the speech. Is virtue teachable? Or is wisdom teachable? And this is settled here by Glomus's opinion. Whether this opinion is good enough is another question. But in any event, Thucydides has shown to have given the two brothers and the others that are standing alone a specimen of what a protracted speech is. And you see, the farce is not limited to what the prize do. This is grossly farcical, but this is also farcical. Not grossly, certainly, but still. So the whole dialogue takes place on two levels, one can say. On the level of the proper speeches and of the level of Socrates' protracted speeches. They are, of course, at different times. One could perhaps eat a blackboard. So they are on one level. Although there are, of course, at different times, because you can't two people or two circles, you can't draw at the same time. Yet, they are in a way simultaneous, you know, because the building is a very, very minimal. And then we have this advantage in for time, and then we have to begin the next section, to the next time. Mr. Phoenix.
Did you think that in his protracted Socrates implicitly took one side or the other of the question of whether wisdom is teachable? He seemed, without saying it, in a way to sort of be speaking only about scientific wisdom or knowledge, as opposed to a kind that people might have prior to any actual teaching by experts. For example, it might be that people, you might say to avoid those consequences, like saying that food is bad for the man that doesn't know how to use it rightly, that fresh air is bad for the man that doesn't know how to use it rightly, and so forth. You might say that there is a kind of pre-expert knowledge of how to use those things rightly, but when he gives that all the list of incapable people that are better than the capable ones, he seems to assume that there can't be anything like that. So then does he come down on one side of that question of whether wisdom is teachable or not?
I don't see the connection between the two questions.
Well,
lovely question, isn't it?
No, I mean, it may just be my point, but I don't know. How does civilists argue, generally speaking, from certain premises which are granted, and if they are not granted, he, under certain conditions, tries to establish them?
Yeah.
But what are the left in, now, for example, if you take the case of characters, where there is such a great initial difference of opinion between civilists and characters, do you remember? And the point where characters gets into trouble is that he doesn't, that he is not willing, and he says the good is identical with the pleasant. And Sinodus mentions some disputable pleasures. Yeah?
Yeah.
And he doesn't have the consistency to say they're also good. Well, not particularly pleasant, but good pleasures are good. And because he gets more indignant, this is fair to his opposition. So in other words, when Sinodus establishes something against the contradictor, it is not necessarily a genuine refutation. It is a refutation of this particular individual given his particular opinions or inclinations. It is not necessarily a philosophic refutation. I'm sure you mean something, but I would like to probably something serious.
When Socrates exhorts Plinius to wisdom, he's presumably exhorting him to pursue a certain way of life which he wasn't pursuing already, or pursue it more than he was already, right? Yet, if Plinius was already wise due to just being a human being, to fortune or to something, without having to have a teacher of wisdom,
that's unlikely.
Be necessary.
It's unlikely. He's after a very young boy. And let's assume 14 or 15. And he must have certain opinions about wisdom. He says the word so frequently. And what the question is, where could he, since no attempt was made, that is probably what you are aiming at. So he doesn't say a word as to what wisdom is. How can he, to what does precisely does Granius assent? Is that the point you mean?
Yes, and well, I was wondering whether it's partly just mysterious what he agrees to, but perhaps he agrees to something specific without realizing it to a degree also, namely that to philosophy or the kind of systematic knowledge that philosophy presumably seeks.
Yeah, but this is, of course, something very hard to avoid. But when the word philosophize, occurs here, you must not take this in the sense which the word is taken on after Plato. Philosophize means level of wisdom. And what wisdom is, that is anything. Is an authentic dialogue, many friend of Socrates, young friend of Socrates, his aspects of those, who do you regard as wisest men? And then he says, Homer in epic poetry, Socrates in tragedy, Socrates in painting, and so on. What he understands by wisdom, what we would call the arts, the fine arts, the world poetry. An able statesman or politician, so of course also regarded as a wise man. Wisdom covers all these things.
Yeah, that's...
But that one must be personal. If you assume that a man coming from the house from which he comes is likely to be politically ambitious or to be pushed by his family in that direction. If any of you will ascend by wisdom, above all the ability to conduct the affairs of the city in an effective and manner redounding to his glory. But that is wholly undefined. And it should be that the suitors consider this a chance to tell the two brothers they should continue the protracted speech in their expert-like manner. He says they should then show which kind of knowledge one must. It is which makes the man wise. This would go in the direction of your question. If you get a clear notion of what wisdom means.
Right, yeah.
Or if I misunderstand
Well, I guess it seems right that there isn't really any specification there of what's meant by wisdom.
Yeah.
I can see.
Well, the example Socrates gives, isn't there in a way a direction given to what the question, to the answer of what wisdom might be? Because he seems to give examples, first of all, of the arts, the art of flute playing, the art of grammar, and then generalship and sailing also. I mean, he doesn't mention anything like prophecy or something that sort of is inspired. And wisdom seems to be
the art. Your wisdom. That is clear. But see, there is an enormous number of arts. But one could say without, I would say without it, that if he did properly understand the wisdom, the highest arts, the most ethical current arts, which are they? Or which is it? It could only would be the art of the statesman. The political art, or the kingly art, that this would come up very much later on in the dialogue. And in the second part of Socrates' protracted speech, and in Socrates' second conversation with Crito, that will come up. But there is also a reference to, as you already know, as the term is not used, to a more theoretical understanding of wisdom, where wisdom means something like dialectics, in the Platonic sense. We come to that approach, I hope, later on, and then we must see whether we can make it good. But hitherto it's clear. Hitherto it has only just been shown in a rather dubious argument, and with the help of some dubious examples, that wisdom is the sole good and is omnipotent. But what that wisdom is dark. Whether that is a political art, the art of the king, or whether it is something radically different from the art of the king, but rather what later on came to be called philosophy in a more precise sense, that we cannot decide on the basis of what we have read to the two. Yes.
It doesn't seem to square too well with what we hear, because he arrived at the final clinching argument that wisdom is the greatest of all things by means of showing that in order to make good things good, you've got to know how to use them. So apparently wisdom is the right use of whatever you've got to use. If you have little things to use, wisdom
is the new thing.
So wisdom is
doing the
best with what you've got.
If you've
got a state, you
can. Yeah, but the trouble is, wisdom is practical wisdom, is finances. But the trouble is that there is also things of the arts which do not belong to finances, to practical wisdom. There's a carpenter, there's a pilot, the physician and so on.
Well, the carpenter has wood and tools.
Yeah, Yes, but then you become the whole range of the arts, the whole variety, and you, as the word wisdom forces you to make a distinction between the arts which are wise in an emphatic sense and those which are not, and then you would ultimately come to something like the raw art, the political art, smell peak, on the other side perhaps something like mathematics, and beyond mathematics something like dialectics.
Would that be the art of being a man, the art most
popular being? How far the argument in this dialogue goes, we must see. I mean, after we have some other platonic dialogues dealing with this question, the Republic, among others, the Service and Statesman, and so on. And if this is on a lower level, but for this reason, not to be dispersed in any way, as I hope you have seen. Yes.
What effect is Socrates trying to have on Euthydemus and Dionysodorus by giving this proclivity? And he says it's an example and wants them to do something similar or to continue it, but particularly when it's covered in such detail and so on, it's hard to imagine that he really thinks that they will, in fact, take it as an example. What he is trying to bring out from them, or to show them, or to show the other people.
Yeah, there are two possibilities. The first is, I also don't believe that he thought for a moment they could do the same thing better than he had done it. But see, what else, what other purpose could he have? After all, they are not the only ones present, are they? Who is the chief person, in a way?
Clarence.
And Clarence, after all, one doesn't know in a way that is a thoughtful question. Will Clarence be more impressed by Eurydemus and his brother, or by Sybaris? And if Sybaris impressed him more, that made all more ready for his later life.
Isn't the wisdom of the brothers seem to be a candidate for this highest wisdom that Socrates is urging Clarence to? And that if we take literally what Socrates says to Crito the next day, that he's found these brothers to be all wise.
Yes. That is, of course, that is a crucial question. To what extent is Crito aware of the irony? He is surely not, he is a certain awareness, I think he is, but how deep it goes, I have no notion. Let us see what we can find out about that.
I hope these last two questions away bring up the problem that Mr. Wedderby raised with you on the phone. And that is that it would seem that while the distinction between narrative and performed dialogues on the one hand seems to be very clear, on the other hand, every narrated dialogue is performed either to a known or an unknown audience. In this case, we know the audience is Crito. We don't even know if there is anyone else but Crito. It doesn't say they're alone. He may be alone. It seems to be alone, but he may not be alone. From the second remove, the addressee of Socrates' whole narration is Crito. And we don't see he can't discuss his moves with relationship to Crito.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, every narrated dialogue,
he can talk with a certain freedom about the people he talked to yesterday, can we?
But I'm saying, doesn't our interpretation of the whole narrated dialogue depend on our interpretation of why Socrates is saying these things to Crito?
Being a polite man tells him. And if that isn't sufficient, you can simply say that Sybaris told it to Crito, so that perhaps Crito might tell it others, who others might write it down, and saw a certain son of Moshe that was his wisdom, or however we call it, would be perpetuated. But to stick precisely to what is going on in the dialogue, I would say the dialogue is important, so was by the fact that Plato asked him what happened yesterday, and so that is gives him a report. But he gives the report, but the report is not verbatim, we have seen. And that Sylvius gave it with a view to Plato, with a view to what Plato needed, and to what Plato could understand. And that goes without saying. The fact, if you want to clear distinction between narrative and performed dialogues. But there are dialogues which consist of both a narration performed is in no way of course a refutation. It only shows that there are mixed cases. In all fields of human endeavor, you find that you have clear cases and you have mixed cases. And you start, of course, from the clear cases to understand, I would understand them from the mixed cases.
Well, then what you would say, would you say that there are some things in what Socrates says to Crito which are not intended for Crito, but for someone else that Crito might tell it to?
Yeah. Or to speak somewhat more realistically about reading the things. Yes, well, then I think we meet again next Wednesday. Yes, Mr. Meekins. Yes, Mr. Meekins. Are you the one who wrote for us the statement of Mr. Bloom and Mr. Bezier?
I don't have it with me.
But in permanent.